Today's Minnesota Reads is made possible by the bookstore at Fitgers, a full-service book and toy store located on the bottom floor of Fitgers on Superior Street, online at fitgersbookstore.com. This morning, we're talking about a book called A People's History of the Hmong by Paul Hilmer, and he joins us on the line this morning. Paul, good morning, and thanks for being with us.
Good morning, and thank goodness for this beautiful weather at last, eh?
Yeah, well, that's easy for you to say. Yesterday, I think it was in the 40s or 50s here, and I heard someone say it was 83 in the cities.
84 and plenty windy, but still worth it.
And I took a few moments to just shed a tear or two.
My apologies for the entire state.
Thank you. Paul, you created this fascinating book, which is one of the most fascinating kinds of books because it's actual people talking about their actual stories. The genesis of this project, if I'm understanding correctly, came out of a class assignment. Can you explain that a little bit?
Well, it actually started even more simply than that. I was taking one of my Hmong students to an internship at the University of Minnesota, and I just started making small talk. Tell me about your family, your father, whether he was a veteran during the war, how long your family stayed in the refugee camps before coming to America. And he just turned to me and said, I'm sorry, I don't know. My family is so busy. My parents have two jobs each, and I have to take care of my younger siblings, and we just don't have time to talk about that. So
wow.
I simply asked him, do you think you have other classmates who feel the same way, who are in the same situation? He said, oh, yeah, absolutely. So we gathered a group of them, came up with the literature that was available at the time, came up with a list of questions, sent them home to tell you how long ago this was with Radio Shack tape recorders.
Wow.
And they interviewed mom and dad or grandma and grandpa, someone in their family, and they came back with these remarkable stories. About a history that I knew precious little about, which probably says as much about my lack of attention as anything else. But it really started very modestly and simply as a desire to get my Hmong American students to learn more about their own history.
What a wonderful gift that must have been to those students, because I'm guessing that they probably have those recordings somewhere, maybe dubbed from cassette to CD to MP3, perhaps, but to have that kind of conversation with their parents. How did they react when they came back, having learned about all of these things for the first time?
Well, my favorite response is probably from a high school student who did an interview in a later stage of this whole process. She wanted to do it, and then she decided to back out, and her principal said, look, you've made a commitment here, and you really need to step forward and do this if you can. So she went ahead, and on the recording, you can hear her rather grudgingly asking her father some stories or some questions. And when she got to, what was life like back in Laos, and he said, oh, well, he started explaining some things, and she started to move on to the next question. He said, no, I'm not done yet. I want to tell you about how I kidnapped your mother.
Wow.
And she said, you did what? And so he began to lay out this tale of one of the Hmong practices of if you're interested in a young woman and you don't think perhaps that her father will say yes, there's an accepted ritual, this isn't a criminal act or anything, where with her consent, you take her to your home and then inform her parents that you have brought her home as your bride, and then the negotiating begins. But he laid out this long, long tale of adventure, misadventure, suffering, death, ultimate survival. And what she said to me was, I always thought he told me those stories to make me feel guilty. I didn't know they were true.
Wow.
So I think there was a lot of understanding, and what I try to tell students who participate in this over the years is you're going to learn as much, if not more, about yourself as you are about your parents and grandparents, because those things that happened long ago, even if you don't know about them, they still shape you.
That awkward moment when you discover your parents are much more interesting than you had ever dreamed.
Yes, indeed.
I'm waiting for my daughter to make that discovery, but I really don't foresee that happening anytime soon, and that's fine with me. There were a couple of things that really struck me about the book that seemed so fundamental to the story that you almost need to explore these things a little bit first before you can put the rest of it in context. And one is that the Hmong culture had little or no written history.
Yeah.
What are the ramifications of that?
Well, clearly everything is passed down from generation to generation orally. And while I'm sure it was done as faithfully as possible, we can't even keep our written history consistent from generation to generation. So you can imagine a history that's dependent on memory and memory alone. Even so, that was an advantage to me as I interviewed Hmong elders who had spent their entire lives relying on their memories, and also, unfortunately, having lived through a number of traumatic experiences with adrenaline coursing through their veins. That, too, has this way of cementing memories in our mind. That's why, unfortunately, people suffer from PTSD. They can't purge those memories because of that very experience. But to get back to your question, what it meant was that this entire period that I was trying to study relied on stories that, for the most part, had been written by other Westerners, having spoken to individuals involved, without a lot of official correspondence or other kinds of archival information available to use. So it was all that much more important to speak to as many different people as possible, to get as many different perspectives as possible. And even so, saying up front, you know, this is just one version of the history, told from 100 or 200 different perspectives, but nonetheless, there will be other things out there that we will need to consult to try to get this history told even a little better and from even more perspectives as possible.
One of the things that's fascinating as I talk with more and more authors who have written nonfiction books about history is the idea that for the most part, up until maybe now, maybe, everybody's got a slant. Everybody's got an agenda.
Oh, yeah.
Historians of the time, we talked about that a little bit last week, about how historians of the time really kind of wanted to gloss over the way they were handling the Indian conflicts in Minnesota in the earlier days. And they wanted to let people know that Minnesota was a safe place. So they had kind of a marketing agenda, and they had kind of a, you know, these practices don't bear too close scrutiny, so we're just going to kind of gloss over them. And so from the standpoint that you say, well, this oral history, somebody's got, you know, it's slanted because it's an oral history from someone. But in many instances, as you're talking about, Western histories about other cultures have slants also.
Everything.
And maybe agendas that are even more obvious.
Well, that's the bottom line is all of us have agendas. They don't need to be sinister. They don't need to be manipulative. But simply because we are who we are, we see things a certain way. And that lends itself, of course, to interpreting history a certain way. I teach a freshman history class every semester, and to tell you the truth, it's my favorite class. I love teaching it. Because what students often learn in high school, and I'm trying to cast no aspersion on high school teachers, but, you know, the very process of high school education tends to be focused more on the memorization of data. In college, what we try to do, and I'm sure plenty of this happens in high schools as well, so again, my apologies to high school educators everywhere, but what we try to do is to encourage students to take ownership of their collection and interpretation of information. And that starts not only with an evaluation of outside sources, but with a very honest self-appraisal. Who am I? What am I like? How have my parents raised me? What are my political, religious, social, you know, other sorts of leanings? And how does that affect the way I view the world?
And where am I getting my information?
Oh, absolutely.
Where do I make those choices? One of the other things that I thought was really integral to understanding your book was the idea that these were a people that didn't have a home country.
Yeah.
And so, you know, unlike the Scandinavian immigrants, for example, these people didn't have this the stability and this place called home. How does that inform their stories?
Well, wherever they went, and they originated from China and started migrating into Southeast Asia in the early 19th century, they tended to live in places that nobody else wanted. They lived, for the most part, in mountains above 3,000 feet. So, you know, when we Minnesotans say, how did the Hmong end up here when they lived in the jungles? How can they stand our winters? Well, it is cold here, yes, we can't dispute that. But living up at 3,000 feet is a whole lot different than living down on the jungle floor. And in fact, the Hmong were not, they did not have a good immunity to malaria because there weren't mosquitoes up that high. So they were used to being isolated. They had a very sort of libertarian impulse, leave us alone and let us do what we want. They had a very well-organized clan structure that was both positive and that encouraged a lot of mutual support, but also encouraged a lot of competition between various clans. And so the Hmong were in Laos, in Thailand, in Vietnam, where they settled in the largest numbers, people who were considered outside the bounds of civilization. And to some degree, they appreciated that because they did like supporting themselves. They would come down from the mountaintops and trade for the things they needed and pretty much go right back up again. And so this lent itself to this perpetuation of self-identification, history, culture, and all those other sorts of things that Hmong people still cherish today.
Well, and it sounds like in many instances they are very similar in terms of a mindset to many Minnesotans. We're self-reliant and we handle our own stuff and we help out one another and that connection to family, that sort of thing.
Absolutely, and that was very tough for many Hmong people who came to the United States in that they were so used to being close to their families, close to their children, being responsible for themselves. And they came to America, and what they found out was, you mean my child is considered a child until they're 18? In our culture, we tell children they're adults when they're 14 or 15. And yet I, as a parent, am responsible for my children when they commit crimes or misbehave in school when they're 17 or 18. We don't understand that. Or women would say, you mean I can't take my child with me to work? That makes no sense to me. How can you separate me from my children? So there were lots of periods of adjustment that dealt with these core values that I think Americans, if they look at them in isolation in the Hmong community, admire quite a bit. But when they see people they don't know and don't understand speaking a different language, practicing a different culture, and they see them behave within an American context, think, oh, how strange.
And then it of course it becomes because the Scandinavian culture, what I understand from my own family, was that there was a certain amount of shame after a point to speak Swedish or speak Norwegian, and the idea was to become assimilated and blend in like everybody else as quickly as possible.
Absolutely.
And when people can't do that, either because culturally they're not inclined to, or because they look different than the Scandinavian immigrants, then it's, you know, what are you doing speaking your own language, and you're supposed to be one of us, and this is America.
Well, and that's, I mean, if you look at Scandinavian or German or other cultures, there were plenty of churches still speaking the mother tongue for decades after they arrived here. And that obviously has changed over time. But it shouldn't surprise us then that we see Hmong people coming here and still speaking their language, particularly if you come here as a refugee, not just an immigrant, but as a refugee from a war-torn country, and you're in your 50s or 60s, it's highly unlikely that you're going to become fluent in English if you've never spoken a word of it prior to your arrival. And that was true of many of the people who came from Northern and Western Europe in earlier times as well. I think it's always important, and this is sort of one of the themes of my book as well, is all of us have immigrants somewhere in our family tree. And if we can just look over our shoulder far enough, and yes, some of our family members came here unwillingly on slave ships. Some of us have ancestors who came here so long ago, we rightly think of ourselves as the natives of this land. But still, all of us came here and experienced a kind of transition that fundamentally redefined who our families were, what their values were, what their thoughts about the future would be. And so the Hmong are one of the more recent arrivals, but part of a story that really, in many ways, closely resembles the stories that families from other traditions and other places in the world would tell.
Paul, thank you so much for joining us this morning. It was wonderful to talk with you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Paul Hilmer is the author of A People's History of the Hmong. Minnesota Reads is produced at KUMD with funding provided in part by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and also by the bookstore at Fitgers, a full-service book and toy store located on the bottom floor of Fitgers on Superior Street. Online at FitgersBookstore.com.